The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Elena Nicolou is titled "The Impossible is the True Story of a Family That Survived the 2004 Tsunami." 2012's The Impossible is set in the aftermath of the deadly tsunami that struck the Indian Ocean in 2004. The movie is based on the true story of a Spanish family vacationing in Thailand when the tsunami struck, who miraculously reunited after being separated. This is where the family from The Impossible is now. The harrowing 2012 film follows a family of vacationers in the aftermath of the devastating Indian Ocean tsunami that struck land on December 24, 2004. Based on a true story, it stars Naomi Watts, Ewan McGregor, and a young Tom Holland. Considered the deadliest tsunami in recorded history, the 200-foot wave wiped away entire towns and the lives of over 200,000 people across 14 countries, per the Telegraph. The tsunami first made contact in Indonesia and moved on to Thailand, where The Impossible takes place. The death toll in Thailand was nearly 5,400, including 2,000 foreign tourists, per History.com. Miraculously, the family whose story is told in The Impossible all survived the disaster. Though the Bennett family in The Impossible is British, the real family that inspired the film is from Spain. Maria Ballon, a physician, and her husband Enrique Alvarez were in Khao Lak, Thailand, with their three sons, Lucas, Simon, and Thomas, when the tsunami struck. Here's a look back at their remarkable story and where the family is now. The family was on vacation in Thailand when the tsunami struck. In 2004, the Ballon-Alvarez family traveled to Orchid Resort Hotel in Khao Lak, Thailand for the Christmas holidays. At the time, they were living in Japan for Alvarez's job, just like the Bennetts in The Impossible. The tsunami arrived 3 days into their vacation, per the LA Times. As in the movie, the family was gathered around the pool when it happened. "We were standing in the same positions around the same swimming pool where the families were standing that day," McGregor said in an interview in 2012. "It was really real." Ballon's account of the moment the tsunami appeared is nearly as vivid as the scene in The Impossible. "We started to hear a very horrible sound. I was looking around thinking maybe this is just in my mind. No one recognized the sound. It felt like the earth was coming apart, but everything looked perfect. I was facing the sea and saw a huge black wall. I didn't think it was the sea. I thought it was a black wall coming to get us," she told The Mirror in 2017. Afterwards, Ballon was swept away and separated from her husband and sons, who were in the swimming pool. According to her interview, Ballon believed it was the end for all of them. Doctors told Ballon that she was underwater for at least 3 minutes. Miraculously, all five family members survived. What happens next is what gave The Impossible its title. Against all odds, the family managed to reunite. "I'm here because I was so lucky, but there were many, many others who were not so lucky," Thomas said in 2016 during an interview with the UN on World Tsunami Day. After being swept away, Ballon managed to locate her son Lucas and grab onto a tree trunk. "Lucas and I were hugging in this tree, mostly in silence, but from time to time he would say, 'I'm happy, Mommy, that you are with me.' And I said, 'I'm happy I'm with you, Lucas.' It was one of the most beautiful moments in my life," she told People. "They were found and rescued by a Thai man. The man wouldn't allow me to die. He dragged me through the mud for a long time until he was sure I was in good hands," she told The Mirror. Elsewhere, Alvarez had lost the other sons. Clinging onto a tree, he was sure the boys had drowned, but he too reunited with them. The family's reunion took place 2 days later in the hospital, where Ballon was being treated for severe injuries to her thigh and chest, per the BBC. After life-saving surgery in Thailand, she spent 4 months recuperating in a hospital in Singapore. Years later, The Impossible would film in that same hospital. They were very happy with the idea of the film being made because it was a way of showing the world how they had behaved, which was extraordinary, director Juan Antonio Bayona told Set Decor. Bellone rescued a young boy named Daniel in the water. Bellone and her son Lucas rescued a young Swedish boy named Daniel while he was pulled out to sea. Daniel reunited with his father in the hospital. According to the LA Times, Bellone and her family lost touch with the young boy and don't know his whereabouts. Later, she wrote a letter to Daniel's deceased mother, published in the LA Times. "It wasn't your fault you died, nor my fault I survived. It was fate. But fate has a sharp edge. It leaves wounds and buries scars. Fate isn't always fair, and that hurts. The pain is pain, but not guilt. That pain is like an invisible stone in my shoe, making it impossible to forget. With every step, I'll never get rid of it. The best I can do is to adapt to its presence," she wrote. Filming The Impossible was cathartic for Bellone and her family. The family that inspired The Impossible was involved in the movie from start to finish. The process began with Bellone recounting her story to filmmakers over the course of 5 hours in one sitting. "When we first met, I had two objectives," Bellone told the LA Times in 2012. "One was trying to scare them, and two was to look in their eyes and see if they were the ones who really wanted to swallow this big responsibility." Based on their response to the interview, Bellone decided to trust the filmmakers. As filming proceeded, Bellone wrote letters. One, Delirium, conveyed her fragile state in the hospital when she was losing pints of blood and facing death, the article reads. Bellone also met with Watts before filming and helped inform the role. "I didn't want to pry too much. I didn't want to seem too actory, but she had so much to say, so it was perfect," Watts told the Philadelphia Inquirer. "And something that I didn't quite understand at the time was that she said she felt completely sure of her instinct, that nothing got in the way of it, and she'd never had that feeling before, which made her incredibly heroic because every decision she makes seemed to be the right one." Today, the family from The Impossible is devoted to doing good. The tsunami changed the course of the family's lives. Now living in Barcelona, 54-year-old Bellone continues to work as a doctor and is an advocate for tsunami survivors and a motivational speaker. Alvarez volunteers with Proactiva Open Arms, an NGO dedicated to helping refugees arrive safely to the Greek island of Lesbos, a notoriously dangerous passage. Per a statistic from October 2019, 19,000 migrants have drowned in the Mediterranean since October 2013. Having lived through certain situations in the past doesn't desensitize you. Instead, you empathize more with others. Things feel closer, Alvarez told the Huffington Post. All three boys, like their parents, are devoted to philanthropy as well. Lucas, played by Tom Holland in the film, had a heroic moment of his own this summer while working as a doctor in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. The 26-year-old studied at the University College in London. Middle child Thomas chose to study in a university in Wales specifically because of their rigorous lifeguard training program, he told the BBC. He too continues to raise awareness about tsunamis through his own experiences. "While it's important to reflect on the past, it's equally important to change the future," he said in an interview with the UN on World Tsunami Day in 2016. Simon, the youngest, who was 5 during the tsunami, now studies in the Netherlands. He also volunteers as a lifeguard with his father's NGO, per his LinkedIn. Each year, the family gathers on a beach on December 26, the day the tsunami struck, to remember. "No matter where we all are, this is a commitment we have forever. We need to be close to the souls of the dead," Bellone told People. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, "How to Find Inner Peace and Happiness in the Chaos." Inner peace is possible, and you don't need to meditate on a mountaintop or break the bank for a wellness retreat in order to find it. Carving out time to relax is wonderful, but it's amid the frantic pace of everyday life when we need serenity the most. That moment when you're stuck in the pharmacy line and the contents of your bag spill on the floor just as your phone starts ringing? That's when you need to find inner peace within yourself, right as you're suppressing the urge to unleash a stream of four-letter words. I think often people look for circumstances to help achieve a sense of inner peace, says Ashley Davis Bush, psychotherapist and author of The Little Book of Inner Peace, Simple Practices for Less Angst, More Calm. In fact, this calm, compassionate, deep awareness is actually within each person. It's as if we have a deep reservoir of peacefulness and serenity inside us. What we have to learn to do is tap into it. With the help of what Bush calls micro practices, you can get better at accessing your inner calm, even if it's been in hiding for a while. Peace of mind doesn't require peace and quiet. Have you ever been scuba diving or even just watched a good deep sea documentary? The ocean's tide brings the drama when it crashes against the shore, but venture a few meters down and you'll find a tranquil world of creatures moving at their own pace, wholly unfazed by the action up above. The problem is most of us live sort of on the surface of the waves, where there's a lot of turbulence and wildness, says Davis. But again, this deep, calm awareness is actually within each person. Davis maintains that you don't need to shut out all the noise to find inner peace. There's this assumption that if you're in a quiet place, it will be more conducive to accessing this spot within. But in fact, there are people who have panic attacks while they're on a massage table. You can be on a New York City subway surrounded by people and noise and close your eyes to go into the space where your calmness resides. Breathe in, breathe out. Your breath is always with you, and both yoga and meditation practices harness the power of breath control to help shift your state of mind. Davis likes to recommend practicing the 4-7-8 breath, which is based on a time-tested yoga technique because you can do it anywhere at any time. Close your mouth and inhale through your nose as you count to four. Hold on to that breath as you count to seven, and then exhale through your mouth for the count of eight. The long exhale helps stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is basically initiating a relaxation response in your body, Davis says. Make sure to breathe really low to fill your belly with air. Feel the truth that you're safe and loved. Remind yourself that you're breathing, and hopefully you're physically protected, says Julie Pottaker, mindful self-compassion teacher and author of Life Falls Apart, But You Don't Have To, Mindful Methods for Staying Calm in the Midst of Chaos. Think about the people you care about and the people who care about you, Pottaker suggests, saying that focusing on that can lower your panic response. Let the truth of that warm your heart. Visualize your happy place. This is another micro practice that becomes easier the more you do it, and the stronger your visualization, the more effective it is. It's okay if it takes you a while to conjure up what that go-to happy place is. You might want to picture the ocean or your bedroom under your covers, a lake view, playing with your pet, being with someone you love, or maybe a favorite vacation, Davis suggests. Then try to really get all the details in your mind's eye. The smells, the sounds, the textures, the touch. Accessing these vivid memories will cue your body to start feeling like you're actually there, which will relax you, she says. Read the story you're telling yourself. If you find yourself spiraling over a perceived disappointment, frustration, or panic-inducing thought, try stepping back to assess whether what your brain is telling you is true. Examining the source of your turmoil can make it feel smaller in size. I tell my students that what you resist persists, and they need to feel it to heal it, Pottaker says. She often recommends the RAIN technique, an acronym first coined by meditation teacher Michelle McDonald. Recognize what's happening. Label the emotion, because simply naming it calms down your over-arousal, says Pottaker. Allow your situation to be there. You're not resisting it or trying to numb it and run away from it, she says. You're allowing it to be there long enough to work with it. Investigate. Pottaker says to ask yourself, what most wants my attention? What am I believing? Where am I experiencing these feelings in my body? Can I put my hands on where I'm feeling it and soften the area? All of this inquiry is done with love, not judgment. Nourish. This is alternately defined as natural loving awareness. You've observed yourself, and it's time to treat yourself with loving kindness. Ask yourself, what do I need to hear right now? Podiker says, just talking to yourself like you would a dear friend is extremely helpful in healing. It staves off the feeling of isolation. Act your way to deeper self-compassion. There's no one road to self-compassion, so here's another way to think of it. Davis suggests trying a three-step method she calls ACT, based on the work of Kristen Neff, a prominent researcher in the field of self-compassion. A is for acknowledge, as in you acknowledge your suffering or your struggle. This really sucks, Davis says. C is for connect, connecting to all common humanity to remember that you're not alone in this. Other people get frustrated, feel angry or impatient. The T is to talk kindly to yourself. When it comes to positive self-talk, Davis echoes Podiker's recommendation to address yourself as you would a friend, because using I sentences may make you feel more isolated. Research shows that when you talk to yourself in the third person, you actually activate the care circuit in your brain so that you feel more cared for, she continues. You're accessing your higher self so that you can talk yourself off the ledge and you feel more supported. So I would say, Ashley, you're going to be okay. This is a really hard moment, but don't forget, Ashley, you're not alone in this. Make a joy list for when you need it later. While a compassionate inventory of how you're feeling is a powerful mindfulness exercise, Podiker says asking yourself, what do I need to do right now, can remind you to lean on actions that tend to give you peace. Since many people find it challenging to remember which activities bring them joy when they're currently feeling mired in chaos, Podiker recommends looking to a joy list that you've compiled ahead of time. Free associate what brings you joy and then pick something on the list to do when you're feeling lousy, she says. While you're doing that thing, such as flower arranging or baking, savor it. Take it in for a few moments because taking in the good rewires your brain for happiness and resilience, Podiker says, citing the work of psychologist Rick Hansen, PhD. If you look at a beautiful sunset and say, that's a beautiful sunset, what's for dinner? Podiker says you haven't given your brain a chance to truly form a positive connection. Instead, try to fully give yourself over to the moment, noticing the rich colors of the sky, because that's productive work in its own way. Just letting you fill you up for that moment of awe is enough to rewire your brain for happiness and resilience, she says. You can do this multiple times a day, Podiker adds, building up a joy reserve by just savoring those first sips of morning coffee or the sound of a child giggling. Cultivate gratitude for what's happening and not happening. The psychological benefits of gratitude have been championed repeatedly in the field of happiness research, and according to Davis, practicing gratitude is another way to quickly access that state of inner peace. She suggests two simple ways to get into the habit: keeping a gratitude journal and smiling as soon as you sit up in bed in the morning. When you smile, it signals to your brain that things are good and that you're happy. If you find yourself struggling to think of what you're grateful for in the heat of a chaotic or frustrating moment, Davis suggests you start by naming what you're glad isn't happening. And boom, now you've got something to be thankful for. To go back to her earlier subway example, in a crowded commute, you might think, I'm glad I'm not being mugged right now, or I'm glad it's actually moving and we're not stuck in the dark. I'm glad it's air conditioned. I'm glad I have a seat. I'm glad I have a physically healthy body. One small positive thought often sparks another. Ask yourself two questions daily. Your gratitude journal entries don't need to be lengthy reflections like some burdensome daily homework assignment. Instead, Podiker says use these two simple prompts to list an item or two for each. What did you enjoy today, and what am I grateful for today? Maybe you did something that's on your joy list, for example. Serve others to help yourself, too. Everybody knows that when you help other people, you feel better, Podiker says. Even in the coronavirus pandemic, there are plenty of ways to help, including dropping off canned goods or volunteering virtually. Those in the field of positive psychology believe that the good feelings that come from truly meaningful acts cultivate something they've deemed eudaimonic well-being. Over decades, research has suggested that in the long term, the eudaimonic happiness that people feel from doing something like volunteering or making someone else feel good is more rewarding and longer lasting than the more commonly pursued hedonic well-being, which prioritizes seeking pleasure and minimizing pain. Thus, building up a reserve of eumonic happiness through acts of service could potentially up your general inner peace baseline. Maintain good self-care hygiene. Eating right, getting plenty of sleep, exercising, meditating, and practicing what Poderker calls mindfulness daily life activities can all shore up your mental peace defenses for when all hell breaks loose in your world or in your head. Even while you're just brushing your teeth, you can focus on feeling the toothbrush, tasting the toothpaste, and hearing the sounds so you're not worrying about your to-do list or what just happened in the news, she says. That's a mindfulness and daily life activity. It's all about developing the pause so that when you feel yourself reacting to a situation, you're better prepared to respond in a calmer way. Practice acceptance. In the larger pursuit of learning to access your inner peace, Davis says that accepting the existence of things that are out of your control is the long-term goal, difficult as it may be. Acceptance is an overall way of engaging with life, she explains, so it's less about a quick practice and more about a life orientation. When we resist our circumstances, we create a lot of suffering, which of course is the opposite of inner peace, she continues. And the second you start going with the flow and putting yourself in alignment with what is, you immediately start to have a sense of flowing with rather than flowing against. It's a challenging process, and one your brain may resist on impulse at first. That's why it's called practice. You may not nail it the first 15th or 50th time, and that's normal. In terms of practice, I might say to someone, right when you're in a situation like you're in a long grocery line, you can't believe it, you're late for something, you're feeling really stressed, just stop, drop into your heart space and say, this is what I've got, this is where I am. I'm just going to flow with this, and I'm going to look for an opportunity now to just practice patience and practice self-compassion. This is really hard. I wish I could be faster. I wish I wasn't in this line, but I am. It's okay, and I'm okay. Our next article by Ariana Davis is titled, Oprah's partner, Stedman, says he only found his purpose after overcoming low self-esteem. Oprah fans know the name Stedman Graham well. O's longtime partner has appeared on several episodes of The Oprah Winfrey Show, in the pages of Our Magazine, and even on Oprah's Instagram. Still, throughout their more than 30-year relationship, Stedman, whom Oprah sweetly calls Honey Graham, has mostly stayed out of the spotlight, supporting and cheering on his significant other while she shines. Thanks to his low profile, some may be surprised to learn that Stedman is a successful businessman, CEO, and author. After playing basketball in college and professionally overseas, he is 6'6" after all, the Whitesboro, New Jersey native got his master's degree before working with and traveling the world with Robert Brown, who was a special assistant to President Nixon. Later, Stedman would work in various fields from public relations to teaching and nonprofits, eventually becoming the president and chief executive officer of his own sports marketing company. To date, the now 66-year-old CEO and father of an adult daughter, Wendy, has published 12 self-help, motivational, and business books. His latest from 2019 is Identity Leadership: To Lead Others, You Must First Lead Yourself, his personal guide outlining the 9 steps anyone can follow to become a strong leader. And leadership, he argues, isn't just about sitting at the head of the conference room at work. This concept came from my realization that in any part of your life, there's identity and then there's leadership, he says. The philosophy is simple. You can't lead anybody else until you know who you are. But Stedman admits that learning his own identity and becoming a leader wasn't an easy journey. I got a lot of pressure on me. I've been written about in the tabloids. People try to make me look like I don't know anything or can't do anything because I'm in a relationship with a very powerful woman and all of that, Stedman says. Not only that, I've got a race-based consciousness. I have 2 disabled special needs brothers in my family, and I've dealt with low self-esteem and a lack of confidence in myself. That's a lot of stuff to deal with, and you have to be emotionally strong to deal with it. And if you're not emotionally strong, you end up self-destructing. So I wanted to write this book to help other people find their identity and their purpose, because putting yourself first is number 1. Ahead, Stedman shares his tips for finding your own purpose and happiness in life, plus his advice to anyone in a long-term relationship like him and Oprah. Spoiler alert, it involves date nights. You mentioned overcoming quite a few obstacles before you found happiness. How do you think your journey has led you here? When I was growing up, I was always looking for equality. I felt like I was a second-class citizen because of my race. It took me years before I realized it wasn't about my race. It happened while I was traveling the world working with Bob Brown. He helped me see that people of color in other countries were making things happen. I was from this small town where I was told nothing good ever comes out of Whitesboro and I wouldn't make it because of the color of my skin. I was programmed to believe that, but eventually I learned that's not true. The biggest problem I had was that I didn't know who I was as a person and I didn't know what my skills were. So realizing that, I said to myself, you got a lot of work to do. You're sitting around a victim, but the color of your skin is never going to change. But what you can change is the way you think and how you feel about yourself. And there's a process for that, and that's what I write about in the book. It's all about preparing yourself, because Oprah says it all the time, success is when preparation meets opportunity. So you have to create a roadmap so that when you reach the destination of success, you're ready. People hear leadership and they think that means at work, but you talk about leadership in all aspects of your life, including family. Ahead of Father's Day, what advice do you have for other dads? The advice I have is for dads and moms. Work on yourself every day. End of story. That's all you need to do. As you begin to work on yourself, you will compound your interests, you will compound your values. And when you realize that the value you give yourself is also the value you give the world, including your kids and your family, you realize, I want my family to be proud of me first. Our country is currently talking a lot about what makes a good leader. I know you've said that Oprah would make a great president. What do you think we should be looking for in office? Oprah would make a great president. There are several characteristics that make a good leader: discipline, self-determination, drive, knowledge and understanding, resilience, strength, focus, knowing how to build good relationships, patience, courage, taking risks, loving yourself, loving other people. We can go on and on with what makes a good leader, but those characteristics are key. Not only are you Oprah's partner, but you're also good friends with Gail. What's one of the best lessons you've learned from her? I've watched Gail raise her kids. I've watched her take care of her extended family, including her sisters and the people around her. It's a beautiful thing to see because she has purpose, taking care of people and the news. She's always loved the news and she's stayed grounded in that. She's hardworking and she's curious, but she's also good at taking the bad stuff and bringing the good stuff forward. And that's really important for any leader. What's a typical day in the life of Stedman Graham like? When do you feel like you're living your best life? That's every day. Every day is Christmas. But for me, I'm really trying to get back to my workouts. I start with some cardio, weights, then go get some juice. Then I have my newspapers. I get about 7 newspapers a day, so I go through those because I'm always looking for ideas and innovation. And I travel a lot for work, so when I'm in the airport on a typical day, I'll pick up magazines that are relevant to my business and what I love and I care about. Knowledge is really important to me. I'm a big reader, and Oprah's a great reader. When you're around a reader like Oprah, who's very successful, you think, I need to read more. So whether I'm working or traveling or I have a day off, I'm always reading because I like to stay informed. You and Oprah are two leaders who are also extraordinarily busy. What advice do you have for fellow ambitious couples on staying close to your partner? Respect. You have to earn that respect. And sometimes you have to go to the pit to get it. Sometimes you have to go to the bottom of the barrel to get it. Getting respect requires sacrifice and humility, not ego. It's about learning how to be resilient. And sometimes that means not opening your mouth just because you're frustrated, but keeping it closed and sucking it up because not everything needs to be a fight. Sometimes you need to sacrifice what seems important in the moment and look at the bigger picture instead. What's a perfect date night for you and Oprah? It's just having dinner together because we're always around a lot of people and she's very busy, so having quiet time together at home is a beautiful thing. I enjoy that more than anything else when we get a chance to relax and just talk. That's the best time together. We don't have to go to any special restaurant. It's those moments just having conversation that are important. She once told us that you love her black-eyed peas recipe. Do you have any other favorite dishes? I'm a fan of food, everything but beets, and she's a great cook, so it works. And I get to enjoy her cooking every once in a while, but I enjoy her company most of all. Also included in the article are Stedman Graham's 9 steps to leadership success. Check your identity. Create your vision. Develop your travel plan. Master the rules of the road. Step into the outer limits. Pilot the seasons of change. Build your dream team. Win by a decision. And commit to your vision. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is Oprah and Stedman's 30-year romance is the epitome of hashtag relationship goals. For over 30 years, Oprah and Stedman Graham have been one of Hollywood's favorite couples, long before hashtag relationship goals was a hashtag. But throughout the media mogul and the entrepreneur's decades-long relationship, they've managed to keep their union private, sometimes treating us to a quote or two in an interview or the occasional but adorable social media post. Yet despite keeping it quiet, it's clear that Oprah and Stedman have a close connection. The key? Respect for one another's accomplishments. Lady O has often called her significant other supportive, and Stedman shared a similar sentiment. "We want each other to succeed," he said during a segment on The Oprah Show. "And I want her to succeed and to be as successful as she possibly can, so I encourage that." How did it happen? Oprah suggested that she manifested Stedman. On an interview with Hoda and Jenna and Friends, she said, "I did manifest him because I'd been through a lot of woof-woofs. You get the point when you say no more. I actually said, this is what I want, someone who is kind, someone who is loyal, and that's what I have." To celebrate the moments they have chosen to share with us, from how they met to their engagement and decision not to marry, to supporting each other's careers, we created a timeline of the Oprah and Stedman love story spanning 3 decades and counting. 1986, Oprah and Stedman met for the first time. According to Vanity Fair, Oprah and Stedman met at a charity event. That also just so happened to be the same year of the first season of The Oprah Winfrey Show. As we all now know, the two have been a power couple ever since. But at the time, Oprah confessed to People magazine that her staffers were suspicious of the handsome 6'6 businessman, who was also a sportswear model at the time. They figured if he looked like that, he either had to be a jerk or want something, she told the magazine in 1992. "He's kind and supportive. Lots of people want to ride with you in the limo, but you want someone who will help you catch the bus." 1987, Stedman made his first appearance on The Oprah Winfrey Show. During a segment for one of the show's earliest episodes, Stedman surprised his lady love while she was filming by calling in during a Q&A with viewers. And what did he want to know? What Oprah had been telling her bestie, Gayle King, about him. "I don't know if you recognize my voice or not," he said to a surprised Oprah, who stood in front of her delighted audience. "Stedman, is that you? Steady, honey," Oprah replied. "Yes, baby, how you doing?" he responded. Cue the swooning. "Your friend Gayle, who you talk to about 6 times a day, every time I see her in person, I'm wondering what she knows about me. I kind of have to look down when I see her because I don't know if she knows how many gray hairs I have on my head or what color my toes are." As any girlfriend would, the O of O quickly but lovingly shot his question down. "Okay, honey, I'll tell you later, okay?" And that was that. So we still don't know to this day exactly what Gayle knows, but we do know people in high places. Maybe we could ask her. 1992, Oprah and Stedman announced their engagement. The famously private couple made their engagement public in 1992. With a then 38-year-old Oprah and then 41-year-old Stedman opening up to People about his proposal. According to the publication, Gayle and Oprah were at her home waiting for Stedman to bring over a tape of the latest episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show. But when Lady O's partner finally got there and she went to greet him, the businessman popped the big question. Apparently, it was a pretty straightforward affair, as reported by People. "Is this the proposal?" she asked. "I want you to marry me," he said. "I think it's time." To which Winfrey replied, "That's really great." And while at the time they planned to get married the following year, in 1993, a wedding never happened. More on that later. 2015, Stedman became a grandfather. In May, as reported by the Daily Mail, Stedman's daughter from a previous marriage, Wendy Graham, gave birth to her first child, a baby girl named Cadence. Neither Stedman nor Oprah has commented publicly about his grandchild, but when we look at how Oprah treats her girls from her school in South Africa, we can only imagine how loved the little girl is. 2017, Oprah revealed why she and Stedman never got married. After taking to Twitter in 2016 to address rumors and set the record straight that she and Stedman had never gotten married, Oprah opened up to Vogue about why a marriage between her and her longtime beau would never work. And it turns out the topic is a lot less complicated than it sounds. The subject simply never came up again. "Nobody believes it, but it's true," she said. "The only time I brought it up was when I said to Stedman, what would have happened if we had actually gotten married? And the answer is, we wouldn't be together. We would not have stayed together because marriage requires a different way of being in this world. His interpretation of what it means to be a husband and what it would mean for me to be a wife would have been pretty traditional, and I would not have been able to fit into that." January 2018, Oprah and Stedman were each other's dates at the Golden Globes. In a rare public appearance, Stedman showed up for his leading lady and accompanied her to the 2018 Golden Globe Awards, where she gave a rousing acceptance speech that inspired presidential rumors and the hashtag Oprah2020 to go viral across the internet. Stedman agreed that his partner would make a great president, according to the LA Times. Later that year, in March, Oprah opened up in a podcast interview for Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand Goop, saying that the reason we don't see her and Stedman out and about more often is because with every sighting comes a new photograph, a new story. For his part, the author's low-key lifestyle is in no way a sign of resentment. "We have what a lot of people have who are in a relationship, and we've been in a relationship for a long time," he once said during one of his only three appearances on The Oprah Show. "That's not always an easy thing to do when you're a man in a relationship with a very powerful woman. And so I'm not threatened by her fame or her success or all of that. So that's who she is. It doesn't have anything to do with how I define myself." August 2018, Oprah revealed her perfect date night with Stedman, and it involves black eyed peas. While answering questions from OprahMag.com readers on Instagram last summer, there was one particular query that resulted in a golden Oprah answer. What's a typical date night like for her and Stedman? Lady O didn't hold back, revealing that the key to her partner's heart is simple, a home-cooked meal. "I'm a really good cook," she told us. "My favorite date night is to make him black-eyed peas and cornbread as a surprise for dinner. And then, honey, hush, that's all you need. Some black-eyed peas and cornbread, that's it. Perfect date night. Me cooking, and then it's on." Yes, you know if you have Oprah saying, "Honey, hush," it's gotta be good. Actually, can we get that recipe? May 2019, Stedman released his book, Identity Leadership. And his sweetheart showed her support. With an Instagram video of Stedman proudly showing off his newest work, she wrote a short but loving message, complete with her partner's pet name. "Honey Graham, I know how much this means to you. Congratulations." Our next article by Elias Rodriguez is titled, "Family in Black Cake is Forged Through Tradition and Invention." Late in Charmaine Wilkerson's ravishing debut novel, Black Cake, an earthquake strikes California. Having long prepared for the big one, the type A marine scientist Byron grabs his emergency bag and the hand of his widowed mother, Eleanor. When they escape the building, his mother exclaims, "The fruits, Byron, the fruits!" Byron hesitates. He thinks his mother could not possibly expect her only son to risk his life by going back into their kitchen to pull a 2-liter glass jar, 68 ounces of ebony-colored slosh out while a seismic event was in process. But she does. The container holds ingredients for the titular dessert. It is all Eleanor feels she can bequeath her children. This is at once hilarious and poignant. On the one hand, the jar may already be broken by the tremors. Even if it isn't, what parent in their right mind would endanger their child for a not-yet-baked rum cake? Fruits can be replaced. A son cannot. On the other hand, it's devastating that a mother might think that all her child has to inherit from her is food. Such a belief not only foregrounds that Eleanor, as a migrant, has been alienated from the very place whose traditions and culture she hopes to pass on to Byron, it also reminds the reader how little she thinks she has given her son in the daily practice of raising him. Food is consumed and then gone. The lessons a parent teaches through an upbringing last, if not forever, at least longer than a meal. This juxtaposition of contrasting emotions, humor and devastation, glee and fear, and more, is characteristic of Wilkerson's novelistic style, and one reason it is so affecting. In many ways, Black Cake tells the tale of what could drive a parent to risk so much for the sake of a dish eaten at celebrations and holidays. Set between an unnamed Caribbean island, based on Jamaica, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the novel is a migration narrative about the ways civilian and state violence push Black people to leave behind their kin and their country in pursuit of safety. It is also a story of traditions forged through difficulty, of exiles holding on to the past as it slips through their fingers, and of new generations misunderstanding their inheritance. Sometimes the stories we don't tell people about ourselves, Eleanor narrates midway through the book, matter even more than the things we do say. Divulging those secrets, however, does not bring about a simple happy ending. Her revelations only beckon further questions for her children. Heritage, especially for the migrant, is defined as much by loss as by preservation. Chronologically, the novel begins in the 1960s Caribbean, where a young Covey Lynn Cook has been abandoned by her mother. While her father gambles away his earnings, Covey finds solace in swimming and in the arms of Gibbs Grant, with whom she plans to move to London to study. Their dreams are deferred when Covey's father becomes indebted to local gangster Little Man, and he offers Little Man the only thing of value that he had left, his daughter. The plot provides Wilkerson the occasion to wondrously imagine an island and a people, to render the sea's beauty and danger, and to capture the ways poverty endangers the young without reproducing the ageist belief that they are simply objects unable to act for themselves. Covey takes control of her future at her wedding. Forced to marry her father's creditor, she attends the ceremony in a daze until Little Man consumes a poison drink and dies. While Shock arrests the attenders, Covey flees, leading everyone to suspect her of murdering her husband. Knowing that capture will lead to incarceration, Covey takes on her mother's last name and travels to the UK, leaving behind her dreams of a brighter future. In the process, Black Cake provides a fascinating depiction of the ways that identity's meaning and stability changes over time, depending in part on the ways that governments affix a person to a name, and in part on the ways people make sense of themselves. Covey's flight gives rise both to a portrait of the long-running difficulties of exile and to a careful, historically grounded representation of the difficulties that assailed many Black women during the Windrush migration. In London, Covey is treated like a woman from the islands, meaning that strangers stare at, cajole, and shun her. She avoids her countrymen for fear of recognition and grows lonely. After a train accident, nurses mistake her for a woman named Eleanor, and she does not correct them. With this new identity, Eleanor finds a husband, Bert, and moves to California, avoiding East Coast cities where they might encounter their countrymen. Though they build a family together, Eleanor's isolation still hurts. The false narrative that Eleanor had woven for the benefit of her loved ones, Wilkerson writes, had become a net that had trapped her. While Black Cake portrays building a family in a new country as no small triumph, the novel renders its characters as multidimensional, complex humans by reminding that the elation of Eleanor's victories is always tinged with the loss of her alienation from her countrymen and from herself. The lovers at Black Cake's core are not the only victims of these defeats. When Eleanor passes in 2018, her son Byron and her artistic daughter Benny reunite after years of estrangement. They meet with Eleanor's lawyer, who hands them a note from her. B&B. There's a small Black Cake in the freezer for you. I want you to sit down and share the cake when the time is right. You'll know when. The two balk at their dead mother's request. Neither has forgiven the other for having cut ties years earlier. Then the lawyer plays them a recording Eleanor made just before she passed. Her story of her many lives and names only agitates her children further. And what is Benny supposed to do with these feelings, Wilkerson writes, now that Ma is no longer around? Similarly, Byron wonders, how could she drop this bomb on them and then leave them to deal with it on their own? Listening to the recording is far from her last request. She also sends them to seek out long-lost kin and friends. Her unfinished business is both a gift and a burden, and it is the very escape that made those tasks necessary that determines the lives of two children who had never set foot on their ancestral homeland. As Wilkerson convincingly and movingly suggests, migration is not a one-time event. It is a process whose effects ripple across generations, long after one moves to another country. In its tale of a mother's losses and triumphs, Charmaine Wilkerson's Black Cake avoids the simple catharsis that one might expect or even hope for from divulgence. The novel is packed with revelations. Every 30 pages or so, a new mystery is introduced or solved. But these do not entirely redeem the violence of the past. Telling the truth does not undo the pain of carrying secrets. Eleanor had lied to her husband for all those years, Wilkerson writes midway through the novel, because she understood that if you wanted someone to keep loving you, you couldn't ask them to bear all of your burdens. And coming clean alone does not reunify her family. Yet Wilkerson's is a vision of heritage defined as much by deficit as by abundance. Covey had ended up here not only because of her father's foolish ways and little man's cruelty, Wilkerson writes when Covey arrives in the United Kingdom. In Black Cake, there is no ignoring the real histories of violence that create diasporas, not even for those born elsewhere. But there is also no ignoring all that it makes possible. Foremost here is a titular Black Cake. The rum-soaked dessert provided Eleanor's family friend with an income, and some of those earnings paid Eleanor's passage to London. In the United States, Eleanor and her husband share the dish to celebrate their anniversary in a country far from the one in which they hope to build a life. And she baked the cake with her daughter once a year and ate it with their family during holidays. In all those years, Wilkerson writes, Bert and Eleanor couldn't go back to the island, but Eleanor wanted to hand some kind of family tradition down to the kids, like the Black Cake. That cake was all she had from her childhood. But what Eleanor bequeaths her kin is incomplete. When Benny finds her mother's recipe, she discovers a list of ingredients with no quantities. And as one food expert points out, the dish is not even indigenous to the region. It's made with raisins, currants, and sugar, which arrived in the Caribbean as part of the transatlantic slave trade. Black Cake was, according to Byron, essentially a plum pudding handed down to the Caribbean by colonizers from a cold country. Just as Black Cake derives from a history of violence and yet remains delectable, so too does the Caribbean immigrant result from and exceed their history. This balancing of pain and perseverance, of loss and of victory, and of tradition and invention, is what makes Eleanor send her son back into the house during an earthquake. It is also what she leaves him and what Wilkerson leaves her readers long after Eleanor has passed. Our next article by Catherine Pittman and Eleni N. Gage is titled, Ways to Spark Change in Your Community. The opposite of hopelessness? It's helpfulness. The following ideas will inspire you to start a chain reaction of change in your community. Serve up some leftovers. Just about 11% of American families don't have enough to eat, but 30 to 40% of the food in this country ends up in the trash. That math didn't add up for Robert Lee, the son of Korean immigrants, who was raised in a food insecure household in Queens, New York. He launched Rescuing Leftover Cuisine, which crowdsources volunteers to ferry extra food from restaurants, shops, and schools to homeless shelters, soup kitchens, and other charitable organizations. And those extras add up. In 2020, the organization redirected 1.5 million pounds of food, or roughly 17 tons per week. The group operates in 16 cities from the South to the Midwest, with volunteers signing up online to staff pickup and drop-off events near them, cutting waste and feeding the hungry in an hour or less per session. Get creative. When my son Leo joined his school sustainability club in second grade, we traded plastic straws for metal ones, got a composting bin, and battled fruit flies each time we tossed in banana peels, and thought deeply about litter. Our efforts were not enough. Mama, said Leo, now 8, I want to find my own way to help the earth. He decided to think outside the socks. Needle and thread in hand, he launched Those Darn Socks, a service through which the 60 or so residents of our building could leave their threadbare socks and a 25-cent fee in an envelope at our door and get them back the next day carefully fixed by Leo. If you can recycle bottles, he says, you can reuse socks. We all know socks aren't enough, but it got our neighbors to consider whether new life could be breathed into something else they might toss out. Or so said Leo's best customer, the retired geologist in apartment 311. Enjoy VIP status. That stands for volunteers in parks, and it's what the National Park Service calls the almost 250,000 folks who pitch in at our 423 national parks and monuments each year. At volunteers.gov, you'll find opportunities to use your skills to do things like remove non-native plant species from Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, which allows local flora to grow, or translate and transcribe records of immigrants who arrived in the U.S. from the 1890s to the 1930s for the Ellis Island Discography Project at the Statue of Liberty National Monument. Hang with the OG crew. Why not get to know some of the longest-standing members of your community? In Portland, Store to Door of Oregon organizes participants to pick up and deliver groceries to seniors who can't easily shop on their own. In New York City, you can visit seniors in hospitals or at their homes through Encore Community Services. Nationwide, if you register on elderhelpers.org, you can volunteer to give a ride to, clean house for, or just keep company with a new old friend. Share your passion. As an author, I believe in buying new books, but the co-inhabitant of our 400-square-foot duplex, my husband, believes my hardcover habit creates an obstacle course and a fire hazard that could land us on hoarders. When the stacks of books rising from our floors make it feel like the walls are closing up, I load up my backpack, hop on my bike, and head from one little free library in my neighborhood to the next. Dumping a bin at Goodwill would be more efficient, but a lot less fun. I imagine each book as a gift to my neighbors and try to tailor the present to their tastes. I leave my hippie reads, volumes on magic and advanced vegetarian cooking I failed to master, at the little free library outside the Boise Co-op Natural Grocery Store, where I once spotted a shopper nabbing my old cookbook. We got to talking and she gave me a great recipe for sautéed beets. The little free library by the patisserie is often stuffed with children's books, so I add breezy rom-coms to amuse tired parents. And because the one near Camel's Black Park has the highest foot traffic, I drop off buzzy new releases there to up the chance that a passerby will spot a novel that's on her to-be-read list. The best part of my route isn't the fresh air, the exercise, or returning home to cleared floor space. That part's for you, honey. It's biking back a month later to discover which gems have disappeared. I see my brilliant friend found a new home, I think, wondering which of my neighbors is turning Elena Ferrante's pages enthralled as I once was. Be a dog's best friend, at least until they meet their forever human. Foster-based rescue organizations help keep animals out of high-kill shelters by finding them temporary homes until they're adopted. Muddy Paws Rescue in New York City organizes volunteers to not only foster pups, but also take them to the vet and stage adoption events. Lucky Dog Animal Rescue does the same for canines and cats in the D.C. area. And in the Twin Cities, volunteers as young as 12 can help host a puppy party for pet seekers and dog lovers through secondhand hounds. If you're ready for a longer relationship, volunteer puppy raisers bring up dogs until they're old enough to be trained as service animals for people who are visually impaired. The Guide Dog Foundation has programs in 10 states plus Washington, D.C. Turn on the water. When she heard that the city of Detroit was cutting off the water supply to 100,000 residents who owed money on their water bill, Tiffany Ashley Bell started the Human Utility, which lets you donate money toward unpaid balances to get the service turned back on, a move that can be life-changing for the sick, the elderly, and families with kids, because children are often removed from homes without running water. Since launching, the organization has expanded to helping people in Baltimore, too. Run for their lives. After becoming the first amputee to complete the New York City Marathon in 1976, Dick Traum founded the then-named Achilles Trap Club, a nonprofit devoted to helping people with disabilities gain strength and confidence through running. Nearly 40 years later, Achilles International trains volunteers worldwide to work out with and provide running guidance to disabled children and adults, as well as wounded veterans who want to train for a marathon or just jog around the park. Take out the trash. I've heard that food scraps and yard waste make up roughly a third of what we throw away, and that composting keeps organic matters out of landfills, where it releases methane, a potent greenhouse gas. That sounds great for people who can toss their fruit peels in a corner of their sprawling backyard and months later use the resulting new soil to feed their lush peony garden. But I live in a New York City apartment, so I bought a countertop bin, ordered compostable bags, and started hoarding the sacks full of fruit rinds and molding bread in my freezer. Twice a week, I haul them to the compost drop-off down my street. Even though I studied up on how to compost in a big city, yes to eggshells and coffee grounds, no to oils and meats, I seem to be doing it wrong half the time. Once when the hot bearded guy in overalls stationed at the bins reminded me to check my fruit peels for stickers, I had to remove three from one sack. The next week, a fellow composter tried to school me, snarling, "You have to take everything out of the bag." But when I told her mine were compostable, she morphed from judgy green police to friendly earth lover, gushing, "I didn't know about those. Thanks for the tip." Engage in a little monkey business. Here's motivation to smile at a stranger. We're hardwired to pay kindness forward, says Lori Santos, PhD, a psychology professor at Yale and host of the Happiness Lab podcast. Santos and her team performed the same study on capuchin monkeys and 4-year-old kids and found that when both were handed a tasty treat or an unappealing food item, then asked to choose what to give the next subject, they usually handed over what they had received. "We have a tendency to give as good as we get," Santos says. "All the more reason to make it something positive." We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.